Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
I'm really pleased to welcome back to RCR Takuta Ferris, New Zealand politician, member of Te Pāti Māori, elected to the New Zealand House of Representatives 2023 in the general election as MP for Te Tai Tonga. And a few weeks ago, we had a good chat with Takuta regarding two issues mainly, and that was his Māori Party Members Bill that would make Waitangi Tribunal recommendations binding on the Crown, and we touched also on Māori customary foreshore and seabed rights. And this morning we'd have a chat with Takuta about Māori wards, the attack on Murray Chong, the New Plymouth City Councillor, and then there's the Hobson's Pledge debacle. Takuta, kia ora, welcome back on RCR. Thanks for coming back.
Hey, kia ora. Oh, that's all good. Happy to be here.
It was interesting. We got a good response to our last chat, varying opinions ranging across the spectrum. But one thing that came through, I got to feed it back, probably no surprise. People thought you were an eloquent speaker. So there you go.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Always nice to be labelled that. All right, before we get to the other stuff, Takuta, breaking Friday, Waitangi Tribunal calls for Treaty Principles Bill to be abandoned in scathing report. We've spoken to people here, want to get your comment on that, who have said that there were never any treaty principles as such. They came later. So if you're going to stick to the actual treaty, principles as defined later on don't really apply. What do you say to that?
Yeah, that's correct. The principles come about as a result of the work that the Waitangi Tribunal was tasked with doing. And when the tribunal was established in 75, there was actually a clear drive from Tiwi Māori for the English text to be let go and for the Māori text to be the text that the tribunal worked from and the country worked from going forward. Now, that was put right to the test, and there was a politician who led the pushback to have the English version of the treaty also included, and his name was Nears. And so that's called Nears Law, that the English and the Māori text are both included in the tribunal's work. So, you know, it's a pretty clear document, you know, especially the Māori text one. It's very clear. And having the English document alongside it makes it unclear what is being said by one or the other, because they're contradictory in some places. So this means that it's not clear what the tribunal's roadmap was to be when it was established. So along come the idea of principles. You know, what's the average of intentions of these two documents? And then, so the tribunal, on a case-by-case basis, would settle first on what the key principles at play were. We're talking about settling things here for iwi. So they would settle on what key principles were on a case-by-case basis. Now, over time, some of the principles rise up as being very consistent, whilst others were unique from one case to another.
So you're talking about a dynamic kind of process.
Yeah, it is a dynamic process. But, you know, that wasn't the desire of the tribunal in the beginning. The desire was clarity based on the Māori text. And what we know now in 2024 is that, indeed, the Māori text is the text of the treaty, regardless of whether you say treaty or tiriti. So that's where principles come from. Okay, so there is no clear set of principles. There's no list of principles. There's only the workings and the decisions and the rulings of the Waitangi Tribunal over its 45 plus odd years, going on 50, and the rulings of the courts. So, if you're asking from the Māori side of the equation, the principles are in easy way, an easy way to give effect to what the treaty means, you know, without being beheld to the actual text of the thing.
Okay. Just want to read out here for folks who don't know exactly. In the National Act Coalition Agreement, both parties made a commitment to introduce a treaty principles bill, as we know, based on existing Act policy and support it to a select committee as soon as practicable. And it's reported here by RNZ, democracy or co-government policy paper defines three principles to be included in the bill. I want to get your view on these principles. The New Zealand government has the right to govern all New Zealanders. That seems okay, doesn't it?
Well, under the right conditions, it seems okay. You see, but under Te Tiriti o Waitangi, it's not what Te Tiriti o Waitangi says. Te Tiriti o Waitangi says that the Crown can have the right to govern in New Zealand. It doesn't say the Crown has the right to govern over Māori in New Zealand. And if you understand the context of the time, even if you just read the preamble before you get to Article 1, you'll come to some sort of understanding that what is being proposed when the Crown is being allowed to govern in New Zealand is that they will be allowed to govern their own people in New Zealand. Now, that's a significant gift. That's a constitutional gifting.
Okay.
You know, because in the treaty is an agreement between two sovereign entities. And sovereign entities don't get to just go into another sovereign entity and do whatever it likes. That's all negotiated in agreement. That's all done diplomatically. And the agreements that achieve that for sovereign entities, even to today, these things are in action today, are treaties. Treaties are what are used to bring two sovereign entities into, you know, a contractual arrangement.
I need to understand what entities mean, the way you say it. So the entity you're talking about on the Māori side is who? The collection of signatories? Or because there was no actual entity as such, was there? As we could sort of conceive it today.
Yeah. That's what the country knows today, but there's a clear entity. It's in the very first words of the treaty. You see, the treaty is a proposal, and it is directly proposed to the chiefs of the Confederation. Those are the first words in Article 1. Okay?
Ko ngā rangatira o te whakamina. So that is the entity.
The entity is the Confederation. And the Confederation of the United Tribes, the chiefs of the United Tribes of New Zealand, are the constitutional group who signed the Declaration of Independence in 1835. So these are some of the real small things. And like, if you're asking me or people who have done a little bit of discovery into the history of the treaty and its history, one of the things you learn quite quickly is that there is a defined group. So there is a sovereign group to whom the treaty is being proposed. You know, this is sort of, it's Treaty 101 in 2024. You know, the sad thing is not enough people know. So there is a sovereign group. There is a sovereign group. The treaty is addressed directly to them, and an agreement is struck one sovereign group to another, i.e. the Confederation of Chiefs, Te Whakamininga, their name in Māori, and the Crown. So the treaty isn't just being proposed willy-nilly to any chief in New Zealand. It's being proposed to the group who asserted their sovereignty internationally in 1835, and that was recognized by the British Crown. So 4 years and 3 months later, when the British Crown shows up offering its next proposal, it's not a new thing. And they know that it needs to be addressed to the Confederation of Chiefs. That's why it's in the preamble. That's why the Confederation are the first thing mentioned in Article 1.
Okay, just go through these other two articles. I don't know if it's... we'll do it anyway. That Act is saying should be included in the bill. The New Zealand government will honour all New Zealanders in the chieftainship of their land and all their property. So does that mean everyone or one particular entity or both together or the other entity? How do you interpret that?
This is Seymour's idea of rangatiratanga for everyone. So a couple of things with this one. The treaty, first thing is that's complete rubbish. that's effectively trying to change the makeup of the two groups who signed originally. Okay, so you and I are pretty clear that, yep, the Chiefs of the Confederation representing Māori signed with the Queen of England. Those are the two sovereign entities, and they got together in the treaty. So Seymour now wants to say that the Māori side of that equation includes all New Zealanders. That's a bit of a stretch. But here's the thing: rangatiratanga for all is recognized and achieved in Te Tiriti o Waitangi. And I'll tell you why. In Article Number 1, the Crown is granted the right and also the dignity of being able to self-determine and govern themselves. And that's not a small gifting when you're dealing country to country. This is anyway, so we'll leave it there. That's one of the most significant constitutional gifts from Māori to the Crown, and so the Crown subjects ever. So there's that. And now the rangatiratanga of Māori is recognized in Article 2, where quite simply all of the pre-existing rights of Māori are recognized and guaranteed to continue. Now, if you take a step back, most people who look at that today, they think, oh, you see, the Crown was gifting you these rights. Okay, but if you think about it from a point of view in a context where Māori were in full control of everything, they were the dominant culture in this country, they had asserted themselves internationally, they weren't considering the crown figure taking rights away from them. Well, they weren't considering that the treaty was gifting them rights. They were just recognizing the fact that, oh, yes, the crown poses no threat to us. Our rights continue regardless of what happens here. So those are two quite different positions to take. One is, well, like I've just described, Māori aren't worried that their rights are in jeopardy. They know that their rights are uncontestable by the Crown coming in. They're simply giving the Crown a right to be here. Okay, so their rights continue regardless. So the Crown's not giving them anything. The Crown is recognizing that the Crown's authority is limited. And the Crown has no authority to contest Māori rights. So Māori rights just keep going right the way through that engagement, that equation. But what the people who are just coming into this conversation and reading it from this end of history, they think that that's saying that the Crown is giving Māori rights when it's not. It's just acknowledging them. Okay, so in response to that, Article Number 1 guaranteed that everyone got the right to be self-governing and self-determining. Article Number 2 acknowledges the fact that Māori rights would continue on. So the Crown was not contesting any Māori rights in 1840.
Okay, and just the third article he wants in this principles bill. All New Zealanders are equal under the law with the same rights and duties. Well, that's pretty hard to argue against. I'm thinking you're probably going to tell me that's already there anyway in the deal that was made. But there are
Well,
two parts to it, but essentially the same thing. Is that what you're going to say?
no, I'll just tell you what Article 3 says. And Article 3 says, in regard to what's been granted to the Crown extends to Māori the same rights and privileges as her subjects in England. And what Seymour and many people fail to do is recognize the first part of Article 3. They just say, oh, see, everyone, same rights and duties they use. The treaty doesn't say that. It says rights and privileges. But what they leave out is the first part of Article 3, where the Queen says, in respect of what she has been granted by the chiefs, she in turn offers this to them. And so she's offering them the same rights and privileges as her subjects in England. And that's an important piece of text in the treaty because she wasn't offering them the same rights and privileges as her subjects in Australia. She was offering the same rights and privileges as her subjects in England. And if you take the first part of Article 3, where she's recognizing the gifts that she's been given, shows she's been given the right to self-govern in New Zealand. Right? She's been given the right to be the sole purchaser of land in New Zealand. That's pretty much it in a nutshell. And so in reply to that, in response to that significant gifting of those two things, she's now saying that Maori people will have the same rights and privileges as her subjects in England. And that has a lot of flow-on things into the international trade type ideas that Maori were into at the time. They'd established trading and all of that. It gave Maori a significant advantage in that regard. But it doesn't come at the rights offered to Maori in Article 3 didn't come at the expense of the rights that are enshrined in Article 2.
All right, to the Māori wards debate now. Where do you see the Māori wards debate right now? We'll get on to Murray Chong in a moment. This is it's been raging for at least a few weeks at this sort of current intensity. Your thoughts on that?
Well, got a couple of clear views on that. I'm on the Justice Committee, yeah. So the Māori ward, the bill came through Justice Committee, so we got to sit down and listen to all of the presenters, all of the people who put forward submissions in support of the Māori wards. And there was days of sitting listening to hearings for 6, 7 plus hours a day, and 99.9% of submitters supported Māori wards, and that includes all of the regional councils who submitted. So we've got this funny thing going on this year, and one piece of it is this Māori wards. And really, if I just go to the heart of the issue, it's the issue is the shrinking of Māori representation, and that's arguably occurring right across the board with the government. And so repealing the bill, and I know the government is presenting it as, oh, we're not getting rid of the wards, we're just putting it back to the original settings, and we're going to give the councils the chance to decide and the local communities the chance to decide, presenting it as a pro and very good democratic process idea. So a couple of things with that. Number one is that it's not really a 100% good democratic idea if what's happening in Kaipara is the example, if a small group of executive council members get to make the decision and they haven't gone and consulted their community at all. So that's hardly a good democratic approach. And then on the other side is, well, they go to referendum, and the referendum will leave it to 5% of the community to decide whether or not they want to retain a Māori ward or not. So that's hardly arguably a good democratic process either. And then you add on top of that, the fact that none of the other distinct wards that a regional council can have has to go to referendum to decide whether it stays or not either. So that's hardly democratic in a 50-50, everyone gets a say approach. So there's that part of the problem, and then there's the shrinking of Māori representation part of the problem, which is really based on Te Tiriti o Waitangi, founding document of the country, the place of it in the nation, right from central government all the way down to local governments, to organizations, so on to schools and all of that sort of stuff. And for me, I've spent 20 plus years in education. I've spent a good amount of that time. We spent more than a decade working in Māori tertiary education. I then went on to an ITP to work in the ITP space as the director of Māori education in Nelson. And then after that, spent 5, nearly 6 years in the university sector. So I've seen a lot of things around the country, organizations making attempts to more, to make a better attempt to represent Te Tiriti o Waitangi in their organizations, to make a more wholesome attempt, to make a
informed attempts at embodying what Te Tiriti o Waitangi means to us today. And they're all sort of small progressions along the way. You know, so there are organizations in the country today, church organizations, education organizations, that have a complete, health organizations have a complete bicultural dual relationship approach to governance based on Te Tiriti o Waitangi. It's not a new thing. So to have a blanket just red score through Māori wards is a very interesting thing in 2024. And I think, you know, that's a broad discussion, right? That's a big discussion. But here's my crux of this argument for the listeners. I listened to about, oh, I don't know, easily more than a dozen regional councils, either their chairs, their CEOs, their senior councillors, present to the Justice Committee. And overwhelmingly, this is what they said. These are the key messages I took from them. They have done the work to garner, to build, to foster, to nurture better relationships with their Te Iwi Māori partners, with their Māori organisation partners, their Iwi organisation partners in their districts. They've done that work over the last 3, 5, 10 years. And they actually have good, mutually respective and mutually beneficial relationships with those local Iwi partners of theirs. That better relationship that they've built has led to a few learnings and a few discoveries. And some of the learnings are that they now understand how dedicated the Māori and Iwi organisation groups are to the local interest. You know, so regional development. That's any Iwi that's got any amount of resources, or Māori organisation with any amount of resources, or Māori population, they are all committed to the long-term view of that district, okay? And we call it the rohe. It's if you're from a rohe, that's home for you. You're never going to, you know, you might go away, but you're always going to come back. So the long-term view of the Māori community, be them community-based or Māori organisations or Iwi organisations, whatever it is, it's a long-term local view. And so the council's now recognised that as a positive in a relationship with the body, the council body, who are responsible for a long-term regional view. So that's number one. Number two is they now know the level of resource that Te Iwi Māori has in their local region. And the level of resource that many Māori have is significant. It's significant to a local community, a local economy, a regional economy. It's massively significant. Many instances, you know, you can either be talking about organizations like Marae and local Māori organizations who will do the hard yards forever, you know, usually on the smell of an oily rag. And you're also talking about things like post-settlement governance entities, that manage treaty settlements, and also commercial arms and commercial legs that they've got going on. So it's a significant amount of local resource that the councils never really had a good purview on. They now know, okay? So that's one and two. They know the level of resourcing in the Māori community. Number three, this is a really interesting one. They spend far less time. Many instances, they now spend no time in court fighting local Māori. You know, so that's saving councils a lot of money by having the Māori community at the table, as opposed to having to deal with the Māori community when they end up in court, because they're not, you know, they're not doing things mutually beneficial. And so, you know, this is the picture that the local councillors who have good relationships with their mana whenua, with their Iwi counterparts, with their Māori communities, these are the things that they were putting forward. And what that said to me, it's quite simple, that the local governments of this country have done the work. They've done the work in the last 3, 5, 10 years to build the type of relationship where you can have a clear and open discussion with your with the treaty partner, because in the local setting, the local government and the mana whenua, well, they're the treaty partnership. Okay, so that's what they've done. They've done the work to create that, and they are finding that that is massively beneficial for the long-term longevity, for the long-term prosperity of the region that they're responsible for. On the flip side, you have a central government who has done not much of that work.
Okay.
And are still in a adversarial position when it comes to what does the treaty partnership look like? What is the capacity of Tiwi Māori to, you know, build into the well-being of the nature and all of that? That relationship isn't there.
What do you say to people who, you know, they'll say one person, one vote, Māori are in a position to go out there into the marketplace of voters, put out their policies, even in groups, and, you know, convince voters who vote for them like they vote for anyone else, and doing it that way is actually truly more representative, despite or even though the points you made about, you know, the sort of the treaty partnership and arrangements. What do you say to those people?
Well, what I'd say to those people is that they should really challenge the idea of democracy. You know, if you dig down into it, you'll find that there are many loopholes and potholes in the idea of democracy. And that's quite a broad and in-depth discussion that, you know, when you get asked questions like this, either in an interview or in a debate space, there's actually not enough time, you know, to really draw out the nature of the failings of democracy. So, well, what I might just add, you know, since we have limited time, what the democracy doesn't account for and the numbers game, right, the numbers game and the individual approach that democracy doesn't account for is the fact that we live in a bicultural country. Now, most people in this country, if we're having a talk about the bicultural country, they'd be okay with that idea. They'd be like, oh yeah, we're a bicultural country. Yes, of course. So if we dig a little bit deeper into the bicultural country idea, you eventually land at, well, bicultural, there's two partners. So who are they? You know? And so we know that they're the Crown and Māori, and the piece in the middle is the Te Reti or Waitangi. And that relationship there between those two groups, Māori and the Crown, conjoined by the Treaty of Waitangi, that's the foundation of the nation. That's the constitutional foundation of the nation. Okay? And so they didn't get together in 1840 and decide to agree. Māori didn't agree to, and the British weren't proposing the democracy of Waitangi. They were proposing the Treaty of Waitangi. And so that instantly sets the idea of constitutional right, where biculturalism sets, and the democratic right, which is about government in this country, which didn't come around for another 16 years after the treaty was signed. So they're two different things. Yeah? They're two different things. And what Māori are really pushing for is for the recognition of the first thing. It's the recognition of the constitutional setting of the nation. Because without the constitutional agreement, without the constitutional sponsorship, you could say, of Māori, if Māori didn't sponsor the Crown into having a constitutional right in New Zealand, there would be no ability for a democracy to exist. So, you know, this is all a bit beyond your average person out there. They're not really down thinking in this level. They're just thinking, oh, one person, one vote. And, well, there are pitfalls in that idea, particularly when you take in the breadth of the history. And now the history is an even bigger problem, it's an even bigger, you know, amount of information to absorb to give you an informed view to then go and have this debate.
No, I take it we can't go through the whole thing here. So
yeah.
But, I get that.
But yeah. But it is important. So just dismissing democracy for it's either good or bad based on a one person, one vote idea, just dismissing that without considering the other things, well, that's highly uninformed position to take.
I guess I'm picking up, you know, you're saying the horse goes before the cart sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
And that's, to boil it down, simple.
It's the horse before the cart. That's all, I might use that in the future to keep that story shorter.
Okay, feel free. What did you think when you heard that Murray Chong, we spoke to him, New Plymouth councillor, had, you know, some air pellets fired at his car And people have said it's a long bow to draw to say that his support of Mario Ward's moves that we've just been talking about had anything to do with that. But you got anything to say about that?
I didn't hear of it. So.
Oh, okay. You didn't hear about that. No. Yeah.
So what's happening?
But you would say, well, he was supporting the changes that were being put up by government. You've just talked about Murray Ward's, and he's taken a bit of abuse, and he had some air gun pellets fired into his ute just recently, and he thinks that may have been something to do with his position on that. I just thought if you had heard about it, what you'd make of it.
Well, I mean that sort of thing is happening at varying degrees around the country, and it's going to happen more around the country. And so my view on all of that is it sort of rests back on the responsibility of government. And the responsibility of government is to, you know, try and maintain good and appropriate societal settings that, you know, maintain and promote either harmony in the community or respect in the community, you know, that sort of thing. And many of the things that the government are pushing this year are not doing that. They're inflammatory. And so the further you push that cart down the road, the more inflammatory it becomes. And the government are doing this without any sort of real regard for what the fallout might be. To me, that's just irresponsible on behalf of central government.
But you wouldn't support anyone doing that sort of stuff. No one would, right? Because that's...
Oh, no. Don't condone any... way too far. No, yeah. Don't condone any violence, any of that carry on.
Yep.
And there's no need for
it. Got you on that.
You know, if parties, you know, if groups who are parties to this discussion can commit the time to sitting down and listening and talking, listening and speaking, listening and presenting, there is an easier way to get through these challenges than what's being promoted at the moment, which is just to bulldoze through it. And that's how you end up with all sorts of things carrying on.
I want to ask you about this debacle around the Hobson's pledge, full pager in the Herald. And they've faced a backlash, NZME, the Herald's owner, for running that ad front page of the Herald calling for public ownership of the foreshore and seabed. Kawea Te Rongo has condemned the ad as racist rhetoric and factually incorrect. And some of the journalists and a law professor have called for cancelling subscriptions. And I think your party has called for a boycott, I think, of the Herald. What's wrong with people putting out their opinions? You don't have to agree with them. You don't have to be triggered by them. Everybody has a fair shake in the end. So, and we're over cancelling people, aren't we? Come on. So why boycott them for just placing this ad, which clearly passed their terms and conditions to get in?
Well, I think, first off, it's highly inaccurate.
But there's so many inaccurate things out there, but that doesn't stop anyone. It just depends on, I guess, what they're talking about is more the problem, right?
Well, I think in the context of this year, it's highly inflammatory. You know, so it's highly inaccurate. It's also highly inflammatory. And it smacks of a whole bunch of other things, right? But I'll just rest at those two things. You've got a 20-year set of court cases going on. It's the biggest modern day confiscation of rights. So it's highly inflammatory. And I, no joke, I've only just in the last couple of weeks, looked at the Hobson's Pledge website or Facebook page, and all of their stuff is inflammatory. It's, you know, so if you're in control of one of the largest public, platforms, and even more importantly, it's a public perception platform. Whatever you put out informs public perception. And so in a climate like we have just now, is extremely unhelpful, unhelpful, quite irresponsible, extremely irresponsible. And, you know, just shows that if you've got if you've got the connections and you've got the money and you can put something up that'll inform the public, blatantly wrongly inform them, then that's what you're allowed to do if you're that group of people. And really, we should have stronger standards that don't let that be the case.
So, I mean, but isn't that cancelling? Isn't that just dumping on free speech? You don't have to like it. You don't have to agree with it. You can say, just like you have, it's BS. None of it's right. But aren't people smart enough to determine those things for themselves? And we start cancelling everything. I mean, there's so many things on our radio station that people would love to cancel because they don't agree with them. You know, where does it leave us?
Yeah, well, like, you know, I get that. But the degree, I suppose this is about the degree of impact. You know, and they're not cancelled. They got their ad out.
Yeah, but they're not doing another one.
Yeah, that's because someone went back and had to reflect on what they were doing. You know? So you've got the right to step out and do what you want to do. And everyone else has the right to step out and do what they want to do. So us as the
well, effectively, they've been cancelled in that way. It's been successful. They have been.
Well, is it a cancellation? Because we didn't cancel them. We just took an immediate stance that says, well, if you're responsible for a national paper and you're happy with doing that, we will no longer support you because it's number one, factually incorrect. Number two, highly inflammatory. Number three, the state of the nation at the moment, very unhelpful. Number 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. That triggered them. Right. That triggered others to say, well, actually, they've got a point. So, yeah, no, we're not going to support you either. So that's not cancelling. That's responding. You know, so they...
But that's intimidating or driving to a decision. They don't want the incoming.
Well, I don't think that's just called, what do they call that? Market, you know?
Marketplace.
No, your market share is determined by how you present yourself, what you've got on offer, the price of your goods, the quality, the reputation of your goods. So they took a huge slash in the reputation of their paper and they paid the cost because people decided, actually, I'm not going to buy that thing anymore. So they had to go back and reassess where they are. And they've come out with their decision saying, well, actually, yeah, nah, we stuffed up there. This could cost us more in the long run than we're getting from Hobson's Pledge. So they're making a market decision and they've decided to settle on, we won't do another one. And we're reviewing our advertising regulations, you know? So it's hardly a cancellation. It's a response to market-driven forces.
Yeah. Just a reminder that NZ Family First had their full pager over a year ago cancelled. And that was just the definition, the dictionary definition of a woman. So, I mean, it can get pretty damn ridiculous. Should point out that NZME have responded. They said that publishing the ads does not equal endorsement and the decision was made by the commercial team, not the editorial staff. You're probably not surprised to hear that.
Yeah.
Okay. Takuda, it's great to have you back. Really interesting talking to you now. I'm getting into this. So, you know, from time to time, we'd love to have you back again. So thanks for coming back on RCR one more time.
No sweat at all. Look forward to it.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you. So connect with us today.